Welcome back to the Deep Dives podcast here on the No Ceilings NBA podcast feed. I'm your host, Nick Agar Johnson, and back with me once again is Nathan Grubel. Nathan, how are you doing this fine evening?
I'm doing well, Nick. I'm pumped to be talking about another positional classification, another archetype group, and all of the fun ways that we branched out when we were talking about guards. It's time to take that one step further at another spot.
So for those of you who missed last week's Deep Dives episode, we're doing something slightly different, Nathan and I, for these two episode pair. So last week we discussed the guards in what I called a 5-year retrospective. So if you want the sort of longer breakdown on that situation, then go back and listen to last week's episode. But this week we're covering the wings. So, you know, it's one of those things where it's really funny actually, because when I sent you sort of the initial list for this, I had a slightly different archetype breakdown than you did. And I ended up going with the one that you presented to me because, you know, first of all, I thought it was a more detailed sort of version of what I had originally presented, which was just guards, forward, centers. But with the wings, I think, you know, part of the reason that I broke it down as guards, forward, centers is I think there's a lot of overlap between these two archetypes in terms of more, I think, how they were viewed at the start of this exercise than they are now. And, you know, I think a lot of that goes back to the guards discussion that we had, that there's been sort of a separation. And, you know, the place I want to start with this is a sort of shift from heliocentric wings, quote unquote, to those players more being classified as big guards. Now, again, this isn't, you know, the be all end all, right? But just sort of as a general theme, you know, the three players that I sort of think of as players before this exercise came to be that were heliocentric, but were more point forward types than really guards were LeBron, Kawhi, and Paul George. And with Dylan Harper at the top of this class, who we both agreed in very certain terms is a guard, I'm curious sort of your thoughts. Is this sort of distinction that I'm describing between heliocentric wings sort of becoming big guards, is that something that I'm sort of thinking about more just because LeBron, Kawhi, and Paul George are on their way out of the league as sort of the standard bearers for that kind of archetype? Or do you think this is more of a sort of actual serious trend of heliocentric wings just essentially being thought of as point guards or guards, generally speaking, and that wings are shifting to some of the other archetypes that we're going to talk about in a little bit?
So when we discussed this topic in relation to guards on the last show, I think we actually ended at a good place in the discussion, which was how positionless the NBA has become. And I think that's just because the best player on your team when it comes to dribbling, passing, shooting, aka who is the overall top offensive threat, is usually the guy who's going to command the highest usage in your offense, right? When we're talking about wings, I think an excellent player to talk about is Jason Tatum for the Boston Celtics. He's an excellent example, right? So he's someone who I absolutely do classify as a wing because he's spending the primary amount of minutes on the perimeter, right? He's either on the wing, he may find himself on some possessions in the corners. There's also other possessions where he's the first guy to touch the ball after the guard brings it up the floor, and he's initiating an action at the top of the key. Bottom line is, when the Celtics are at their best, usually the ball ends up being in Jason Tatum's hands, especially late in game and in crunch time situations. And that's because of how he's evolved as a passer. That wasn't Jason Tatum's role when he first came into the NBA. When he first came into the league, he was primarily a secondary action wing or a spot-up shooter out of the corners. That's how Boston utilized him. And through Jason Tatum's own work, he became a much better ball handler. He became a much better decision maker. He became a better passer. And so he evolved into that type of wing that you're outlining with someone like a Paul George, for example, who I now get the pleasure of watching when he actually suits up with the Philadelphia 76ers as a Sixers fan. But when we're evaluating somebody like Paul George, he is that poster child wing in the sense of he can kind of do everything from that position. He operates primarily from the perimeter, but he's not the guy who's bringing the ball up the floor. He's still playing alongside another guard. Kawhi Leonard is still playing alongside another guard. Jason Tatum is playing alongside two guards who can either bring the ball up the floor or can come off of actions and can certainly spray the ball out to other shooters, whether it's Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum or whoever else in the Celtics, right? So when I'm looking at categorizing a big guard versus a wing who is just deserving of higher usage, it comes back to, again, can they do the things that I'm primarily looking at a point guard or a guard to do, right? Work out of ball screens, being able to navigate through tight spaces on defense. Can they actually bring the ball and dribble the ball up the floor without losing it or coughing it up on a turnover? That to me is what separates a bigger guard like a Luka or like a Harden or some of these other higher usage heliocentric guards that we can talk about versus someone like a Jason Tatum or a Kawhi Leonard or a Paul George, to where they just have the ball in their hands a lot because they're top tier scorers who can also be trusted to make the right decisions when things break down and they can't necessarily get the shot they initially wanted.
And I think that's, you know, a key sort of way to look at this. And, you know, this discussion came up in the guard section, but I think it's important to bring back here of, you know, the sort of quote unquote positionless basketball thing isn't necessarily size related because, you know, as we talked about, I mean, Magic Johnson was a point guard, you know, in 1980, right? I mean, I didn't bring him up on the last pod just because there wasn't, you know, a particularly good place for it. But one of my favorite NBA what ifs is how different would the league look if Arvydas Sabonis had came to the NBA in his prime and all of a sudden a 7'3 guy was allowed to handle the ball and bring the ball up and shoot three pointers and all of the things that Arvydas Sabonis did for USSR teams in the 1980s.
The, you know, Nikola Jokic before Nikola Jokic.
Exactly. Like, would we have seen more Nikola Jokic's, you know, I mean, I guess there was Tony Kukoc, right? But he's sort of the only player I can think of sort of in between Sabonis, older Sabonis, not the Sabonis that I adore watching for the Sacramento Kings, but his dad. You know, it's the kind of thing where in modern NBA terms, where, you know, there is sort of more of a comfort with not having the positional designations be as rigid. You know, you can have the sort of point that you just brought up that I think is exactly the right point to bring up of, okay, you know, how do we classify these players depends more on what kind of actions they're involved in. And, you know, we had a debate in the guard section about how much of it is defense of who you guard versus how much of it is offense of where you tend to operate.
Which still comes into play, by the way. It's still absolutely a factor. Yep.
No, for sure. But, you know, I think it's a different sort of, as you mentioned, right? You know, Jason Tatum is a wing because of the way that he gets used, whereas Luka is a point guard because of, or a guard rather, because of the way that he, you know, brings the ball up and sort of initiates the offense at the top of the key rather than, you know, running off pin down screens on the wings. You know, I mean, we can, you know, argue about the, you know, rumored fact that Jason Tatum is actually 6'10", but in terms of where they're listed, right, Luka and Jason Tatum are listed at about the same size, but, you know, a lot of that sort of discussion of where they fall in terms of these archetypical designations is, you know, some mix of who they guard and where they start actions offensively.
100%. And by the way, we can even split that off into, I know when you had originally presented me with the podcast idea that you were talking about guards, forwards, and centers just as you led off at the top of the pod. But the reason why I look at guards, wings, forwards, and centers is I view wings as much more perimeter oriented, to where some of their ball skills are overlapping with a guard. When I'm talking about someone like a forward, obviously in today's modern NBA, you know, you have two corner shooters at all times. So certainly you can have a forward spaced out in the corner. You can have them operating inside the arc, you know, around the free throw line area. You can have some of those guys posting up. Like, I think of someone like a Jaren Jackson Jr. who can spend enough possessions, you know, out on the perimeter on the wing solely because he's that good of a three-point shooter. But are you asking Jaren Jackson Jr. to necessarily face somebody up and have to cover ground and dribble all the way from the wing to the basket and be able to make, you know, all these different secondary reads? You know, are you having him to soak in that much responsibility when he has the ball in his hands? No, you're asking him to ultimately be a play finisher. He's a catch-and-shoot guy or he may face up if he catches the ball. You know, let's say he's in a handoff action and chooses the keep rather than hand it off to the guard, and he faces up his man that way, and he has an ability to dribble and get to the basket and finish. He may be involved in those types, but primarily he's a play finisher in the sense of he's catching and shooting, or he's posting up, or as you alluded to in the guards, the guard podcast, like he's in the dunker spot and he's a play finisher. That to me is primarily how I would consider a forward versus a wing who's doing almost all of their damage on the perimeter versus a guard who is primarily responsible for bringing the ball up the floor and dictating the flow of the offense, either as the primary point guard or as a secondary guard next to a primary. So that's kind of like, again, other than the obvious defensive categorizations that every evaluator has used, you are the position who you can guard. That's how I kind of think of separating positions on the offensive side of the ball.
So I have two apologies to give. The first is to you, because I thought of this while we were talking instead of putting it in the notes. And I apologize to Kings fans, because this is an unforgivable offense. But I think the perfect exemplar of all of this is DeMar DeRozan, who starts his career as a shooting guard, makes all-star teams for the Toronto Raptors as a shooting guard. You know, goes to, this is hilarious, his three seasons with the Spurs, his listed position per Basketball Reference: year one, shooting guard; year two, small forward; year three, power forward. And that's exactly what you were just talking about, of DeMar DeRozan is not someone who spends a lot of time spaced out beyond the three-point arc, and he does a lot of his damage, you know, on post-ups, backing guys down, getting to his mid-range spots, and, you know, leveraging his incredible athleticism to get to the rim, right? And I think that perfectly exemplifies sort of what we've been talking about in this podcast of the evolution over, you know, the five-year period and the 10-year period of how players are looked at, what sort of archetypes we think of them as falling into. Because, you know, man, I mean, DeMar DeRozan in 2017-18 made the All-Star team as a guard, and 2022-23 made the All-Star team for the Chicago Bulls, listed at mostly primarily power forward. And, you know, now that he's back on the Kings, he's playing small forward, quote unquote. You know, that's more of a defensive thing, because poor Keegan Murray has been tasked with rebounding and gaining 10 pounds and figuring out how to guard like everybody from Steph Curry to Victor Wembanyama. But that's a different discussion. But I think DeMar DeRozan perfectly exemplifies the sort of offensive discussion that you've been talking about of, okay,
no, 100%.
You know, he starts his career as a guard, and then as the NBA sort of evolves around him, he's still the same player, pretty like almost identical in terms of, like, you know, still a 20-point a game scorer, still does the vast majority of his damage in the mid-range and getting to the free throw line and scoring around the basket, barely shoots any threes.
But I do think there's a key wrinkle when we're talking about someone like DeMar, who has evolved his game in the sense of when he has the ball in his hands. Obviously, he was a natural born scorer in Toronto, and a lot of that bled over into some of his other destinations. So where, yes, he wants to back somebody down, he wants to get to the mid-range, he wants to shoot over someone, but he's become so much of a better passer than he was when he first got into the NBA, to where he sort of embraces that modern wing identity, right? Like, he's not the primary point guard in the sense of I'm going to bring the ball up the floor and run the offense for us, but more often than not, I'm actually going to come off of some type of secondary action, catch the ball. And he's not just immediately shooting the basketball. He is looking to get others involved and sort of be that secondary wing creator more often than not. It's how he evolved his game in San Antonio, and it's some of what he's done with the Sacramento Kings as a wing. So DeMar DeRozan's actually the perfect example of a multifaceted wing, or someone who I would consider a wing in terms of how I define and look at positions, because he's primarily guarding the other team's two or three, and he's primarily handing the ball on the perimeter in a secondary action and either getting a shot for himself or making a decision for someone else. He's not just sitting in the dunker spot. He's not necessarily just a high post guy. You know, he is certainly catching and doing a lot more with the basketball, especially from a playmaking standpoint, than he did initially in his career.
No, I'm very glad that you brought up the playmaking, because that's an incredibly important element of this. But just purely in terms of his scoring focus, you know, I think he, you know, and again, you can come to the conclusion, as you just laid out, that, you know, he's more of a wing because of A, who he guards, because of B, you know, the kinds of actions that he's used in. But, you know, it's just funny to me to look at the positional data from Basketball Reference and be like, shooting guard, shooting guard, shooting guard, shooting guard. Oh, now he's a small forward. Oh, now he's a power forward, right? It's like a lot of it comes down to, you know, again, something that we talked about in the guard section as well of, okay, if there's going to be four out and one in, can you sort of check enough other boxes as the guy who's the one in? And, you know, DeMar DeRozan certainly did that just purely with his scoring, but the passing evolution of his game was a huge element to that. And some of that is, you know, not having Kyle Lowry running the offense and having to run more of the offense himself. But some of that is also a credit to DeMar in the way that he evolved his game to, you know, sort of adjust to the fact that he's never been a prolific 3-point shooter, but, you know, he can do damage in a lot of other ways because of the playmaking development that he's made over the course of his career.
Oh, 100%. And I mean, I love what we're doing is also just a great commentary on how everyone does positions differently and no one has the same definitions. Like, you can go from someone who has, you know, guards and front court, especially like they do now with like the All-Star voting and other types of award voting in the NBA, to someone like me who has, you know, four different positional categories, to someone like Rashad Phillips, who's done an excellent job in publishing a book to where he has 12 different positional categories. He has an entire tree of certain fabrics in which players ultimately find themselves on the tree of basketball. So like every single person categorizes these things differently. I don't think one person's right, one person's wrong. I think at the end of the day, though, when you actually define what positions mean to you and how you categorize them, at the end of the day, I think we all end up at the same spots in terms of the defense, like we've been talking about, but also where everyone falls on the floor from an offensive execution standpoint. I think we all are saying the same thing at the end of the day. It's just funny how we have like five different ways in which we all actually do it or more.
And I think, you know, going back to a term that is both overused and not used enough, you know, the concept of positionless basketball essentially means you're more looking at it as, you know, the way that I've talked about it on this podcast many, many times is with sort of avenues to playing time, right? Of a team needs, you know, let's say four shooters and, you know, three switchable defenders and one, you know, big person near the rim, you know, whether that be a more switchable defender or just your sort of traditional drop center. And, you know, because that's more of a sort of nebulous definition rather than, okay, you are a point guard because you are a guard who passes. You are a shooting guard because you are a guard who shoots. You are a small forward because you are the smaller of the two forwards. You are the power forward because you are the bigger of the two forwards. And you are the center because you are the center, right? When the definitions become more nebulous, there are a lot more different ways to look at it. And, you know, it's a learning experience just doing this podcast with you to sort of talk through, you know, the reason why you have it broken down into four big categories, whereas I originally proposed three big categories. You know, there's a lot of overlap within, but it's a lot of the same sort of concepts. And, oh, sorry.
You're good. I was just, I actually like how you phrase that and how you specifically went into what you look for in terms of what actually works on an NBA floor. I've kind of come to a similar conclusion in the sense of, to me, an NBA lineup, if you're a good NBA team or a great NBA team, you have at bare minimum three guys who can actually create for you, who are legitimate, not just dribblers and passers, but guys who can just read, react, and make decisions on the move with the basketball, and they're not turning it over. And then two play finishers, right? So at least a 3-2 ratio where, like, it's funny, I was evaluating, like, I'll take the Washington Wizards before the season started as an example, right? So if you're considering their primary starting lineup of Jordan Poole, Bilal Coulibaly, Kyle Kuzma, Corey Kispert, and Alex Saar, or you're switching out one of the bigs or you're putting Saar with Valanciunas, however you want to construct that lineup, there was a big split in terms of how many creators you had on the floor versus how many play finishers, right? Like Jordan Poole, to me, you know, we can certainly have our qualms and our disagreements about how good of a decision maker he can be at times, but for better or worse, he's a creator, right? Yeah. Like, as much as I love Bilal, right now, he's still much more of a play finisher than a creator. Kyle Kuzma, for as much as he may think he's a creator at times, he's much more of a play finisher than a creator. Alex Saar, play finisher. Jonas Valanciunas can do some different things in the handoff and screen game, but primarily, he's a post-up, spot-up play finisher at the center spot. So when you have that sort of disparity in ratio, you know, it's one thing to have both corners occupied with shooters, but it's an entirely different thing to have those two corners occupied with shooters who can't do anything with the basketball and make the right decision when they're run off those spots, because NBA defenses, NBA athletes are so good, they will eventually hard close out and they will force you, they will run you off the line. And what happens next with the basketball can be the difference between, you know, stacking up 2 points here, two points on another possession versus those being turnovers, especially live ball turnovers. And now their extra points and extra possessions going the other way. So that's kind of how I've thought about a lot of constructs and how I'm grading NBA lineups and G League lineups, is how many creators do they have? Obviously, it's best if those guys can shoot the basketball, kind of like what you talked about, but how many creators do they have versus play finishers, and what's the positional split and disparity when we're evaluating those lineup constructions?
I am really glad that you brought up this creator play finisher distinction, first of all, because I think it's a very important point, but second of all, because it's a perfect way to transition into the next topic that we have here, which is the further proliferation. I can speak English. The further proliferation of the 3-and-D archetype, which I think is exemplified by exactly what you just said of, okay, if you're going to be a wing who's not a creator, you have to provide a high level of defense and you have to be able to finish plays primarily as a shooter. But that also leads into, you know, cheating a bit, bleeds into the next topic on the list, which is the squeezing out of wings on both ends of the offense / defense spectrum. So fewer spots for both the Troy Daniels pure shooter who can't do anything when he's forced off the line and isn't a great defender, or sort of the Tony Allen archetype of just purely a defensive wing who really, unless he has a free opportunity to cut to the basket, is not providing much on offense. So I'm curious sort of your thoughts on that, because I think the proliferation of the 3-and-D archetype is exemplified by what you just talked about of, okay, if you're going to be one of the two play finishers, you have to be able to provide a lot of value on the other end of the floor. And you also have to at least make defenses pay attention to you offensively. And the easiest way to do that is just shoot from the corner at a very high level.
So when you're posing this type of question, two distinct examples come into my mind for different reasons. The first one would be, what would the New York Knicks look like right now if Mikal Bridges was purely the late Villanova, early Phoenix Suns Mikal Bridges, to where he was just on the floor to shoot threes and defend the other position, but didn't have the other ball skills that he's developed over time, and how when you run him off his spot, he actually has enough of a handle to where he can create, separate, and knock it down a shot in the mid-range, or kick the ball to somewhere else to where it needs to go. Because it changes those lineups, right? Like Josh Hart is technically a creator, but has embraced a lot more of the play finisher, I'm going to do the dirty things to get my team possession, extra possessions, and ultimately help them on the court. You know, OG Anunoby has thought of himself as a creator in the past, but we have kind of figured out that he's much better off as a play finisher. If Mikal Bridges hadn't developed some of those ball skills that he has over recent years, then you're looking at a ratio to where Jalen Brunson has way much more in his plate than he probably should, even if he can handle it. But we've seen Jalen Brunson do incredible, incredible things over the last few seasons. But then he has way too much on his plate. You're putting Karl Towns in a position to where he's not able to properly balance his plate between creator and play finisher. And you're putting a lot more burden on some of those other guys. So I think he's certainly an interesting player to query about when we're talking about this 3-and-D archetype. And then the other one's Luke Dort for the Oklahoma City Thunder, another guy who we may not think of him as having those creator type skills or being able to do that in a pinch. But in order to thrive in that Oklahoma City ecosystem, he's had to get much better at the, I'm going to attack closeout, not just drive and finish at the basket, but I'm going to be able to kick the ball to where it needs to go next. And then in turn, when I do catch the ball and I do have enough space to actually shoot it, I'm going to become good enough of a knockdown shooter to where teams can respect me. And then I'm going to obviously do my job on the other end, which is what got me into the NBA, which is being able to guard multiple positions on the other side of the ball and be that hellacious on-ball defender. So, you know, we look at those guys, Nick, as quote-unquote 3-and-D wings, but they are guys who, had they not developed those other ancillary skills, A, wouldn't be as successful of players as they are from a personal standpoint, but B, would not be contributing to the success that these teams are having this season, which are, you know, they're at or near the top of their respective conferences, possibly on the way to getting to a conference championship or an NBA finals.
I think the development aspect of that that you brought up is really the key there, because I think it goes back to something that I brought up earlier and something else that I also discuss frequently of sort of avenues to playing time, but also, you know, something I bring up a lot of, you know, you're going to earn your way. And this is something that you mentioned in the Guards podcast as well. You're going to earn your way onto an NBA floor, you know, based on what it is that you do best, right? Like mm-hmm. coach is looking for a shooter. Okay, great. You're a 40% 3-point shooter. You're going to go out there to shoot, right? And then the question is, you know, once you earn that spot in the rotation, once you get your foot in the door, what can you do to either A, solidify your place in the rotation, or B, bump yourself further up the rotation? And, you know, or not even the rotation as much as sort of the offensive hierarchy. And what you mentioned with Mikal Bridges is, you know, okay, he started his, you know, he was a starter right away because of his defense and just, yep. okay, you know, you get the ball, you shoot, right? But over time, he developed his game in terms of, okay, you know, as his career in Phoenix went on, he got more opportunities with the ball in his hands. Once he was traded to Brooklyn, he was essentially given free license to, you know, explore the studio space, figure things out. And so now once he's on the Knicks, he's developed more of those creator type skills, A, because he got his foot in the door with Phoenix first and slowly over time started to expand some of those ancillary elements. And then B, he goes to Brooklyn, he has a much higher offensive burden, and you know, that worked great in year one in Brooklyn. That didn't work as well in year two in Brooklyn. But, you know, sort of conceptually, right, he had that studio space to explore those ancillary skills and develop them. You know, it's the kind of thing where, again, if you're the seventh man in the rotation, you're like, okay, what can I do to get myself into the starting lineup? What does the team need in the starting lineup, right? Yep. Is it like, are you not finishing plays at a high enough level? Okay, then, you know, maybe that's the thing where I just, you know, get in the gym and shoot 500 threes a day over the summer. And, you know, hopefully I go from being, say, just for the pure sake of example, a 37% 3-point shooter to a 42% 3-point shooter. And that's how I earn my way into the starting lineup. Or it could be, you know, I don't think we talk about defensive evolution as much, just A, because so much of defense is just predicated on athletic tools and effort. But like, you know, something that I've observed up close and personal over the last 3 years is Keegan Murray came to the league as a do everything offensive player who, you know, you hoped would provide a little bit of defensive playmaking, but he wasn't earning his way into the lineup defensively, right? That was pretty obvious when he broke the rookie record for 3-point makes. Year two, he, you know, gets a little bit more studio space to explore offensively, but the big evolution is he goes from his first 2 months in the league, he was a terrible defender. By March of his rookie year, he was getting to the point where he was all right. By year two, he was a, you know, very, very good, you know, not quite all defense level, but very, very good defensive player who, you know, earned a lot more sort of responsibility by essentially just being the guy that Mike Brown threw on whoever. I mean, year two and year three, both Keegan Murray has literally guarded everyone from Steph Curry to Victor Wembanyama. That's not quite the evolution that, you know, you might have expected given his college game, but, you know, he did what he could to sort of grow his game in areas of, okay, how do I push my way up the hierarchy, right? How do I go from a guy who's, you know, starting because he's an exceptional shooter, but is clearly the fifth starter in those constructions to...
Sure, but...
You know, but sorry, go for it.
I was just going to say, what's the baseline characteristic that we can go back to with someone like Keegan Murray, though, that can help him in that play finisher type role, but he's still able to find his way, not just on offense, but also on defense. It's because he's, you know, 6'8", 220-some pounds, and he's actually big enough and physical enough to be able to contend with some of those higher level matchups that you're talking about, right? Like he's able to hold his own. It's much different for someone for a Keegan Murray who, if he doesn't have those ancillary ball skills and he's on the floor to primarily be a play finisher, AKA spot up shooter, that's fine. Because if he's the guy that where the buck stops, right? Like let's say the ball plays hot potato around, you know, three creators and another play finisher. And he's the last guy who has to shoot it because there's only 4 seconds left on the shot clock. He's still 6'8" and able to get the ball up, right? Like he's still right, able to shoot over defenders. That's how someone like a Duncan Robinson has found so much success with the Miami Heat, someone who went undrafted but has played 7 years in the NBA because he's that good of a shooter not necessarily that great of a defender, but he's 6'7", nearly 220. He can hold his own on that side of the ball. And then if the buck stops with him, he can get a shot up over somebody else. Like you mentioned like a Troy Daniels who has succeeded, you know, once upon a time in the NBA. But as a wing, Troy Daniels isn't working in the NBA the same way as someone like a Duncan Robinson or a Keegan Murray is. And by the way, I'm not trying to shortchange Keegan Murray, Nick, because I love Keegan as well. Yeah. But I'm just saying, like, if that's the bare minimum floor of what he is, he's much more physically equipped to do so, which is a callback to what we talked about or what I tried to outline on the guards podcast. The guard position, the ceilings of those players isn't necessarily defined purely by their size, but the ceilings at other positions absolutely can be either enhanced or closed off or walled off pretty quickly, depending on the physical characteristics of the player. So that's where that positional size does play a factor, especially on the wing or the forward spot, to where if the buck stops with you, you're either big enough to create an advantage, you know, in that last second situation, you are able to get a step on somebody and push them off and create your own shot, or you are that great of a catch and shoot threat to where that added size and that higher release point is a benefit to make sure you're getting that shot off and you're still getting a quality look for your team, even in those dire late second situations.
So I'm curious to sort of circle back the discussion to Duncan Robinson, and not out of any sort of disrespect for Keegan Murray. Obviously, everybody knows how I feel about Keegan Murray at this point.
We all love Keegan Murray, Nick. We all love him.
I know. I just want to circle back specifically to the Troy Daniels example, because I'm very curious for your thoughts on this. To me, him getting forced out of the league was not as much a size thing as a ball skills thing. And the other sort of go-to player that I have for, you know, this archetype was forced out of the league is Ryan Anderson, who was 6'10 and was an exceptional rebounder, but didn't quite have the ball skills to be a creator and didn't quite have the foot speed to keep up defensively. I'm curious sort of your thoughts on how much of, you know, why Duncan Robinson stuck in the league and Troy Daniels didn't was the like inch or two difference height wise versus the sort of ball skill element that Duncan Robinson has of he can do something when he's forced off the line in a way that Troy Daniels really couldn't.
I mean, that's all still kind of coming back to the physical tools, right? Like Duncan Robinson, when he's run off the line, he's still physical enough to be able to finish something around the basket. Troy Daniels for his career was 40% from the field. Right. So if he's 39.5% from 3-point range and he's only 40% from the field, that doesn't mean that he was a great 2-point finisher during his time in the NBA. And, you know, he was a wing. He didn't have those ball skills to be a primary or a secondary creator, but he was only 6'4", 200 pounds. So he doesn't have the luxury of being someone who's 6'7", 6'8", to where, you know, if the buck stops with him, it's a lot easier to run him off of his spot and make him not get that shot up versus someone who's 6'7", 6'8". You know, like a Duncan Robinson or a Keegan Murray with a higher release to where they can get that shot off even if a defender's coming at them on a hard closeout. So, you know, it's walking the tightrope of, you know, if that guy's run off the line versus, you know, someone may be coming at them hard, but are they still able to get that shot off? And that is absolutely the separator. Like everything that you said, it's a mix of all of it, right? It's the fact that Troy Daniels was a 6'4" wing. It's the fact that he didn't have the ball skills to be a primary or secondary career. It's a mix of everything that we're talking about, but it's coming back to the wing position, the forward position, however you want to classify those guys who are spacing out to the corners or are viewed more as play finishers. Those guys need those physical advantages to be able to actually bring to the table what their teams need of them versus, you know, another position like a guard who you don't have to be 6'8" to be fast. You can be 6'1", 6'2", be able to create those advantages that way. And, you know, you have different responsibilities on the floor. If you're a play finisher, having that strength, having that size, that length, that release point on your jumper, all of those things matter when you're in these crunch time situations and these high leverage moments late in an NBA game. So I'd say it's a mix of all of it. I think you honestly knocked it out of the park with each reason you gave.
In my defense, my argument works a lot better if Troy Daniels was 6'6", like I remember him being, and not 6'4", like he actually is. So thank you for pointing that out.
No, but I think it's important to also like with that plays into the fact that he wasn't an above the rim finisher. He wasn't a poor, he wasn't a good shot maker from 2-point range. All of those things matter. And so when you hear some of these people on social media, a lot of the evaluators on draft Twitter go on about, you know, how does this person check out when we're spreadsheet scouting, and what sort of percentages are they from 2 versus 3 and all these different numbers, they all do matter in line with the eye test. Obviously, I'm not just saying that spreadsheet scouting, if you're just a spreadsheet scouter, that you're going to be one of the best evaluators in the space. But I think there are indicators that you can find in the stats to be able to go to the film and ask the questions of, why is this the way that it is? Well, if Troy Daniels wasn't a good 2-point shooter throughout his career, the answers can be on the tape to where, A, his size hindered that, his lack of ball skills hindered that. You know, you can kind of see where everything's going. It's not just one thing that is the answer for it. It's a number of things that when you bring them all together, you can find the actual answer.
So before we wrap up, I just wanted to throw to some of the wings in this current class. And you know, I'm going to bring up 5 names up top, and there are 2 other names that I'm going to mention because I wasn't sure how you would classify them between wings and forwards, but I have them both as forwards. You might have one or both of them as wings, but the wings that I think that I'm not as worried about you agreeing with me or not on whether they're wings, Liam McNeely and Con Knuckle are sort of at the top of that group. And I think of, you know, McNeely is a lot better defensively than Con, but just sort of generally, you know, they're more sort of shooting threat side of this. And then, you know, sort of more defense leaning guys in Hugo Gonzalez, Nick Clifford, and Adu Fiero. And the 2 that I mentioned, I have Cooper Flagg as a forward. I think of him pretty clearly as a forward. So I didn't list him in wings.
I agree.
I'm less sure about how you think of Ace Bailey, but I considered him a forward for the sake of this exercise.
So Cooper Flagg, I definitely have categorized as a forward. I think I'm probably going to end up leaning towards that with Ace Bailey as well. I think I've had him when I first started to evaluate him, like before we actually got into more of the college tape and I got to see more of it on the college floor, I considered him more of a wing, but given the fact that he doesn't have some of the ball skills that we'd like to see from an NBA wing, as well as, you know, getting back to the defensive side and letting that guard our positional categorizations. Ace Bailey has been one heck of a backline defender when he's been engaged, and someone who has been a really good help defender around the basket in terms of blocking shots and being that other guy to come over and double somebody. So I think in regards to where Ace succeeds defensively on top of, you know, him being more of a play finisher than a creator on offense, I think ultimately I actually would agree with you in having him as a forward. You mentioned Liam McNeely, Con Knuckle, Hugo Gonzalez, Nick Clifford, Adu Fiero. I think the only one of those guys that I would consider more of a forward would be Adu Fiero, would be sure. The only one. I consider the other guys wings.
Okay, so that actually really helps for my sort of next point here, which is given that sort of breakdown, this year's draft, in comparison just specifically to the 5-year retrospective, really doesn't have the same caliber of wings near the top that some of the previous years have had. Like, just looking back at the past 5 years, you don't have to go down that far to find the first player that you'd sort of consider a wing in any of those drafts. Whereas, you know, McNeely is the highest on the no ceilings board. I think as of our most recent big board, none of these other guys are even in the lottery. So do you think that's sort of a specific quirk of this year's draft class, or do you think that might be sort of a further evolution of the 3-and-D archetype where more wings are sort of being considered as play finishers and therefore not seen as guys that you necessarily have to take with, you know, one of the top 10 picks, but, you know, maybe someone you look at more in the middle of the first round?
You nailed it right there with the second part of where you were going with your question. I think it lies solely on responsibility of just, you know, where we're seeing positions slotted into in the NBA. If you are someone who can command higher usage with the ball in your hands and make decisions for others, not just yourself, you're not purely a play finisher, I think you're seeing those guys slide certainly towards the higher end of the draft. Like, we can take a look at our board. I mean, Cooper Flagg, We both have him as a forward. He can slot somewhere between the 3 and the 4 spots. Dylan Harper, we talked about in the guards podcast. You know, Jakob Shonis has held a high spot on people's boards. He's a guard, but he's also someone who certainly is comfortable, having the ball in his hands. I think an interesting person to bring into this discussion, and we could have talked about him on the Guards podcast, but we didn't. I'm actually surprised you didn't bring him up, would be Yegor Demin at BYU. Hmm. How do you categorize him and where do you see his future best? Because I got to be honest, I've watched enough of him recently. I'm having a difficult time placing him as a point guard in today's NBA. And I think it's a little difficult to place him as a point guard. And I think it's a little unfair to him as well, right? Like, just because he isn't necessarily someone who would command a higher usage on ball in the NBA because he hasn't shown that scoring punch that you kind of need to have from each level on the floor, that doesn't mean that he can't be a guy who starts out in the wing. And I would categorize him more as a wing at this point, who's getting the ball in a second or a third action and then making a decision from there, because he's one of the best passers in this class, if not the best passer in the class. I think just because he has that type of vision, because he's 6'9", he can see over defenses and he can make those decisions. Everyone wants to run and call him jumbo point guard or call him point guard. When I actually think that's unfair. It's not that he doesn't have some of the ball handling ability. It's not that he doesn't have the vision, but kind of tying everything together between both positions, if you aren't that threat to score with the ball in your hands from each level on the floor, there are just so many different ways that defense can capitalize that and either force the ball out of your hands or force you to take a tough shot. And then you're just leaving points on the table. If their coverage on everyone else is so good and they're taking away your ability to pass, they're forcing you to score. If you can't do that, you're leaving points on the table. So I'm actually curious. He's kind of the perfect player to blend together both of these podcasts. How would you categorize Demin, and where are you at on him right now?
So I didn't bring him up in the Guard podcast mainly because I wanted to be respectful of your time. And if I put every prospect that I could have wanted to talk about, we would have been here for 7 hours.
But I think he's like a good player to sort of end this with, though, right? Like, he blends everything. Yeah,
I think it's a great way to wrap it up, because I think of him as a, and, you know, we'll see how, you know, his recent stretch of tough games meshes with, you know, either better or similar performance going forward in sort of conference play and, you know, higher level opponents. But I think of him more as sort of a combo guard rather than a wing, as someone who needs the right kind of scoring punch around him, but that his best sort of use is as someone who can, you know, maybe not necessarily sort of quote unquote orchestrate the offense, right? Be the primary scoring threat from the guard position, but his best skill to me is his passing. And that's something that is going to work better. You know, this is an incredibly obvious statement, but I think it needs to be made, is, you know, you can't pass if you don't have the ball in your hands, right? So, you know, he's someone who I think needs to be paired with the right kind of other guard, but I see him as more of a guard than a wing because of the kinds of areas where I would want him to have the ball. I would want him to run more pick and rolls from the top of the key rather than shooting off screens around the wings. So it's
on
a difficult
defense,
one.
Who is he going to guard for you?
There
what
we
position
go.
Is he going to guard?
And this gets into the exact discussion that we had in the guard section of how much of this is offense, how much of this is defense. Because,
oh, I'm so glad I got to toss that one back at you. That's the perfect way to tie this all together.
There we go. Yeah. Because no, it's.
I love you. I miss you, Nick. I really do. I love you, buddy.
Yeah, thanks for throwing me for a crazy loop right before we end this. But no, I think he is a great way to wrap this up, because he's so close to the borderline of this in a way that, you know, again, with Bailey, with Cooper Flagg, I'm more confident in them as forwards. With Dylan Harper, I'm very confident in him as guard as opposed to wing. But, and with Yakushonis as well. But Demin kind of does straddle that line in a way that, yeah, I guess he's more of a guard offensively, but more of a wing defensively. So what the hell does that make him? I guess that just makes him Yegor Demin, and we deal with that when the time comes.
And that wraps up our podcast, half of our podcast series on positionless basketball. There you go.
Alrighty.
it was a great opportunity. I had to bring him up because I was literally thinking about this, and I was actually texting with Maxwell about this. And when I was reading other stuff and thinking about other stuff, it's like, you know, especially given Yegor's recent struggles, is it fair that if we find the need to pigeonhole him into the guard position, right? But he's not necessarily the type of guard that we would consider some of these other heliocentric options in the NBA. is it fair to him to knock him down too far on a draft board to where we're not necessarily looking at him as, maybe we're just miscategorizing him by position, and maybe if we slot him in this other area on the floor with these other responsibilities, maybe we're still able to see a lot of the same positives that he brings to the table, and maybe he's just being miscategorized. And so how high should he remain on his draft board? How far should he fall? You know, I don't have him in the top five prospects on my board, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to let him fall out of the top 10 either, because if I see a different role for him on the floor that can accentuate his strengths better than maybe another role can, that's still a player I want to draft in the top 10 because I can see how it works and it fits the modern NBA and it brings a lot of those characteristics together. So it was just a philosophical thing I was thinking about today.
So I think we have come full circle in leaving more confused than we started, but just in case, anything else you want to mention before we wrap this up?
No, these types of podcasts I really do feel like are important for the draft community and anyone who follows the NBA draft and anyone who just wants to get better at watching basketball and evaluating players. And, you know, you and I have rattled through a lot of different topics and we've asked questions and we've had answers, but we don't have all the answers. We're still learning new things every single time we flip on a basketball game, whether it's in a high school gym or it's in one of the most crowded NBA arenas we have, or it's overseas. We're always learning something every time we watch basketball. And the game is so ever rapidly evolving that we could look back on one of these episodes like 3, 4, 5 years from now, and we might think we sound stupid how we're talking about the game of basketball, but everything's changing, everything's evolving, we're always learning, and it's always important to ask questions and look at things different ways rather than being anchored in our prior biases and just being rooted into how we once thought about the game. We always have to constantly evolve in our evaluations and challenge ourselves how we think about the game and how we see it moving forward. So these podcasts, Nick, I think it was a great idea you wanted to bring me on. I want to finish this series with you because I think it's just important content for the community at large.
Well, I don't think there's much better way that we could end than that. So thank you to Nathan Grubel for joining me on this one today. You can find him on Twitter at DraftDeeper. You can find me on Blue Sky at NBA Johnson, and you can find the ghost of my Twitter account at NBA Johnson. If you've been enjoying the podcast, please take the time to leave a rating and or a review in whatever podcast player you might be using. And if you have any feedback regarding the deep dives portion, especially given that we've deviated from the usual formula with this two-part episode, feel free to reach out to me either via Blue Sky or email nickaj.nba@gmail.com. And as always, thanks so much for listening.